From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. Later on, exploring the afterlife. Here's what's happening. Bats may be the source of a new SARS-like virus, which killed a man in Saudi Arabia, according to an analysis of the coronavirus genome. Two other people have been infected, and one was flown to the United Kingdom for treatment. That was in September, still in intensive care. Experts writing in a journal said the virus was closely related to other viruses in bats. It's thought the virus does not pass readily from one person to another. Let's hope. A federal judge denied a bid by a group of Christian churches to force a California beachside town to reopen a park to nearly a 60-year-old Christmas season nativity display. It discontinued after atheists upstaged the event last year. The court action grew out of a clash between sponsors of the nativity scenes and a group of atheists who competed with the church for limited space in Santa Monica, California's biggest public park, and managed to dominate last year's holiday displays with anti-religious messages. While the liquidation of Hostess has been put on hold after a federal judge ordered the company and union officials to come back to the table for more talks, the union that brought the 88-year-old baker of Twinkies and Wonder Bread to its knees was holding out hope that a buyer will salvage chunks of the company and send the union's members back to work, even as Hostess Brands had geared up for a fire sale. Hostess, the company behind Treats Snacks for generations, presented to a federal bankruptcy judge a plan to shut down 36 plants and sell off all the company's business. Catherine Austin Fitz with us, managing director and board of directors of Solari.com. Catherine, first of all, let me ask you about Hostess. We'll get into the housing market in just a second. Is this judge going to be able to save this company, or is it gone?
It's too early to tell. These are situations where anything can happen, George. And you have to understand there's an enormous popular support for Twinkies.
It really is.
So you're going to have a lot of forces trying to come together to save this company because it's going to break a lot of hearts if it goes. Where I live, deep-fried Twinkies is the thing.
Deep-fried, just like a turkey. Hey, housing starts in October, up 2%. People are happy about that. They think that's going to be an impetus to get the economy going. What do you think?
Well, George, the housing market is very interesting now because if you look at both sides of the market, things that are going well and things that are going terribly, you kind of have this seesaw because on one side you have just unprecedentedly low interest rates, and we are seeing housing prices start to come up. Markets tighten that I thought would take many more years to tighten. At the same time, on the other side, we still have a lot of underwater borrowers. The credit is tight. The market has very much depended on federal credit and the FHA. FHA just announced that they're turning into a loss position. So, and if you look at monetary policy, if you look at pricing rises that the Fed announced for September, it's really only tracking with the rise in the money supply and inflation. So it's still early. And I think, we all want to see the housing market do well, but I think that the way that the bailouts worked has very much, they put a ball and chain around the thing. So let's keep watching. I think it's a little bit too early to say that we've come out.
Catherine's website, Solari.com. Catherine, have yourself a great Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, George. Thanks.
Looking forward to that. Being unemployed in your 50s and early 60s may raise heart attack risk by a similar magnitude as smoking, according to a study. They looked at 13,000 people in the United States, indicated that heart attack risk went up by a quarter in the first year after job loss and increased incrementally with further sackings or layoffs. The son of Hollywood Reporter founder Billy Wilkerson has apologized for the trade paper's role in the 1940s witch hunts that saw many in the industry ostracized for having communist ties. The actors, writers, directors, and the so-called blacklist suffered huge damage to their careers as a result. Willie Wilkerson's apology for what he called Hollywood's Holocaust was published in the Hollywood Reporter. He said his father had wanted to take revenge against Studio Titans. Well, he, of course, was just with us on a few weeks ago when we talked about Las Vegas and his father creating the Flamingo Hotel. Willie, this apology came. How did you finally realize that this was going on?
Well, actually, you know, newspapers and magazines, they keep track of anniversaries. I don't. And so the reporter called me and they said, we're doing something for the 65th anniversary of the Blacklist. And I groaned inside and I thought, oh, my God, you know, they're going to do a piece on my dad as this dragon slaying blacklister. And so I said, look, I've been trying to apologize to these people for decades. Let me write a piece that tells the true story of my dad and his motives. And at the same time, apologize to these people who, in 65 years, nobody has stepped up to the plate to apologize to them. So that's the genesis of it.
Okay, and as you pointed out, your father desperately wanted to break into Hollywood in a big way. He was somewhat shunned by the studio moguls, and so he decided, you know what, I'm going to hit him in the belt. I'm going to go after their talent, their directors, their actors and actresses, and I guess that's what he did, huh?
They pissed off the wrong guy. We have to remember that back in 1927, when he approached the studio moguls, he wanted to build his own studio. And at that time, the movie industry was monopolized. It was owned by the movie moguls. I mean, they owned the movie theaters, the distribution, the movie stars. So in order to use their assets, you had to be part of their club. If they shunned you, you could probably still be an independent, but, you know, using their movie theaters, their theater chains, their distribution, I mean, it was out of the question. So that impacted him deeply. And so in 1930, when he began The Reporter, that started this almost two decades war where any club that rolled close to my dad that he could club the studio moguls with, he did it.
He did it, and he
course,
did it.
And anti-communism was won.
And he did it in a big way. Willie, thanks so much. Some great news breaking here in space. Mars, by the way, NASA's Mars rover Curiosity has apparently made a discovery for the history books, but we'll have to wait a few weeks to learn exactly what the new red planet may be. The discovery was made by Curiosity's SAM. It's the Sample Analysis at Mars Instruments, the rover's onboard chemistry lab. It's capable of identifying organic compounds, the carbon compounds that build blocks of life as we know it. So we'll have to wait a little bit to see what they might have discovered. And Earth's oceans and the water that once flowed on Mars likely came from a similar source, meteorites that landed on the planet when they were first forming, according to new research. Up next, Michio Kaku joins us, physicist. We'll talk about all things in space and science in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Two special hours now with Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York, co-founder of String Field Theory, by the way. He is a best-selling author. He's got his own television show. He's a frequent guest on Coast to Coast. Here he is, Michio Kaku, back. Michio, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, George, glad to be on.
It's fun. I'm looking forward to this. So many great things. I do want to get your take, though, on this Mars rover Curiosity. What do you think they might have discovered there?
Well, you know, we're getting closer and closer to, quote, the Holy Grail, and that is being able to establish whether or not there was life on Mars or organic chemicals. We realize that, for example, amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins, we find them everywhere in the universe. We find them in the middle of meteorites. We find them in gas clouds in outer space. And so perhaps even Mars once upon a time had organic chemicals. Now, water once flowed freely on the surface of Mars about 3.5 billion years ago or so. In fact, there was once an ocean on Mars about as big as the United States of America. But the question is, did life get started in that ocean? That's the big question. We don't know.
We don't know. I suspect that the soup of life is probably the same throughout the universe if the, you know, the planets are close enough to its star and it's got water. I just have that feeling. I don't know why. I'm not a scientist, but that's what my gut tells me that.
Well, it could be because, you know, carbon has four bonds. Silicon has four bonds, but its chemistry is not as rich as carbon chemistry. Carbon chemistry is also water soluble. Water is the universal solvent. It's the amniotic fluid where DNA first got off the ground. And so chains of carbon atoms are rather easy to create. And these are called hydrocarbons. And then eventually you can get amino acids and proteins and maybe even nucleic acids. And so the betting is that in outer space, microbial life could be more common than we realize. And so far, you know, the Kepler satellite has identified about 1,000 potential planets in outer space, of which a handful look very similar to the Earth. We haven't quite found a twin of the Earth yet in outer space, but we do believe that once we do find a twin in outer space, it may have liquid oceans, in which case maybe DNA could get off the ground.
What is new with Professor Kaku these days?
Well, you know, this past weekend, something happened which really disturbed me, and that is the sun is having this temper tantrum, and it's getting worse and worse.
Oh,
you know, we had 5 solar flares erupt last week, 2 just in the past weekend. NASA satellites were just overwhelmed by the size of the flare that came out of the sun. Two flares came out of the sun on Friday and Saturday. And we're headed toward the 11-year sunspot cycle maximum now. And the fear is that one of these solar flares could hit the Earth, in which case all hell could break loose.
And, it's just a matter of time, isn't it?
It's a matter of time. You know, we've had a big one about 150 years ago in 1859. We had a huge solar flare that hit the Earth. Back then, we only had telegraph wires, but even they were shorted out. And you could read the newspaper in Cuba at night by the light of the northern lights, the aurora borealis, as far south as Cuba. And from that, we physicists can recalculate how big that solar flare of 1859 must have been. If we were hit with another one like that, it would fry our satellites. Communications would go down instantly. Power plants would be shorted out. And in a worst case, remember, this is a worst case scenario now.
That's right.
We physicists believe that it could be 20 times worse than Hurricane Katrina.
Oh, my God.
So imagine 20 Hurricane Katrina's ravaging the Earth simultaneously. And you can begin to estimate the kind of damage you can get if there's a direct hit from one of these solar flares. And, you know, we're headed toward the maximum. More and more flares are going off the sun. We had another big one last month, by the way. So far, we've dodged the bullet. So far, we've been able to miss the solar flares. But these solar flares are like bullets. Sunspots are like rifles. Think of rifles shooting bullets into outer space and missing mm-hmm. the Earth, because, of course, outer space is quite big. But one of these days, one of these solar flares is going to hit the Earth, like what happened in 1859. And then all hell could break loose.
Yeah, if it's the right size and it hits us on a direct angle, or you know, we are in trouble. And we haven't insulated the grid. Everything could go down. I'll tell you what concerns me too, Mitch, is mm-hmm. what happens if the power goes out? What about all our nuke plants? And we won't have the ability to, you know, they will melt down, won't they?
Yeah, take a look at what happened in Japan. You know, the backup power generators were in the basement. You can't think of anything worse, any worse place to put a generator than in the basement of a building. It was flooded almost immediately by the tsunami. And so the reactor almost instantly was dead in the water. They had no power. And because they had no power, there was no safety systems. And then we had three simultaneous core meltdowns in Fukushima, plus the uranium actually liquefied. We've never seen a totally liquefied core before. First time in history. But the Fukushima reactor actually melted totally. And so we could have lots of these around the country if there's a power blackout because of a solar flare. Simultaneously, we lose pump activity, we lose backup power, we lose the ability to control the control rods. It would be a nightmare.
And how long?
Well, it only takes a few hours for a core meltdown to get off the ground. Yeah. And by the way, at the Fukushima, you may ask yourself a simple question. If the core melted completely, then how come we didn't have a China syndrome? How come there wasn't an explosion that blew mm-hmm. the roof off like Chernobyl? And the reason is that in Fukushima, one of the workers disobeyed orders. He was under a direct order not to flush the core with seawater. because that would destroy the core. The utility thought they could revive the reactor still. They had illusions about that. But he disobeyed orders. He made the only correct decision during the first few days. He flooded the reactor with seawater, and he stopped the devastation of northern Japan. He's a national hero.
He disobeyed orders. He may have saved many, many lives.
Oh, definitely. And we could have something similar if we lose power in the United States or, you know, around the planet Earth. If there's a gigantic solar storm, if there's a hurricane from hell from outer space. Now, we physicists went to Congress last year, and we asked Congress for a few $100 million, that's chump change, to reinforce our power plant, to build a backup grid, to make our satellites so that we could shut them down in case of a major flare, or maybe even have the safety systems on the next generation of satellites. And we got nothing. Congress just laughed at us. But, you know, we're the physicists of this country. We're the American Physical Society. We're the organization of physicists in this country. And we said to Congress that these are rare events, maybe once in 100 years, once in a 200-year event, but it's inevitable. It's inevitable that one of these bullets is going to hit the Earth like what happened 150 years ago. And when that happens, it's going to be worse than Katrina.
It's an insurance policy. Why would they not jump all over this?
Well, they said things like, well, you know, times are hard and, you know, the probability of an event is low. But, you know, power blackouts have happened because of sunspot activity in Quebec, Canada, for example, and in South Africa. Certain cities were hit with solar flares, but they were not a direct hit. They were like a grazing blow to the earth. And we've had power blackouts. Now, see, here's the problem. We're very young in the space age. We've only had experiences with the sunspot cycles for only a few cycles because, you know, Sputnik only went up in 1957. We haven't had experience, but these solar flares have been going on for billions of years. But we never had electricity for billions of years. We've only had electricity for 100 years. And so we have no experience with one of these things. And so it's just like hurricanes. You know, people think that, yeah, hurricanes are bad, but they're very rare. So why bother to prepare for them? Then one day it hits you. And then you lose $50 billion like in Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah, I think it's foolish that they're not doing this, Mathieu. They should have jumped all over your proposals, and that it should have been implemented right now. We should be building infrastructure right now, insulating the grid, protecting our power plants. It's going to bite us one day. I can feel it.
That's right. And, you know, you can imagine the chaos. If all of a sudden we have power blackouts simultaneously across the country, no rescue crews are going to come in from neighboring cities because they, too, will be knocked out. So you're not going to see ambulances and fire trucks from neighboring cities to take care of us in case of a power blackout. And then food is going to rot in refrigerators, you know, as what happened with Hurricane Sandy. It only takes a few days for food to rot. And new fruit is not going to come in from the outside because there is no outside. And so food riots are going to start in a few days because people realize that there's no food to eat because all the food is rotten because there's no electricity. And so you can imagine the kind of chaos you're going to have. Now, here in the Northeast, we had Hurricane Sandy. But, you know, we got relief from the outside. You know, the rest of the country was not paralyzed.
That's right.
The airports were up and running in a few days. And so shipments of food, trucks can come in. But can you imagine what happens if there's no outside, that if they, too, are hit simultaneously with one of these solar flares? And, you know, like I said, we're headed for a solar maximum now. In just a few months, we'll hit the peak of this solar cycle. And so the temper tantrums that we had last week will be multiplied in the coming weeks. And there'll be more and more newspaper reports, especially from NASA, monitoring the sun. Because we never used to do this before, by the way. We never used to monitor these things. Now we monitor them because now we begin to realize, oh, my God, this could really be a big one.
Now it scares. I wonder what the Mayans really knew, Mathieu, when they talk about the Mayan calendar end date. I wonder if it was truly going to be some kind of solar event.
Well, I don't know. All I know is that the laws of physics tell us that this happens every 11 years. The reason for that, by the way, is that the North Pole and the South Pole of the sun flip every 11 years. Because the sun spins, it sort of like winds up its magnetic field lines, like winding the windings of a clock. If you wind the windings of a clock too much, it springs open. It pops out at you, right? That's what happens every 11 years. When the sun spins, it winds up its magnetic field lines, like winding up the windings of a clock. And after 11 years, it can't take it anymore and goes
boing, 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 off it goes.
and goes north-south flips. And so we have a pole shift for the sun every 11 years. And this has been going on, of course, for billions of years. But we didn't have a space program back then.
We didn't have
power grids back then to worry about it.
Michio, we're going to take this break. We're going to come back, talk with you about parallel universes. A couple hours with Michio Kaku right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Michio Kaku with us. We'll take calls with Michio next hour. Michio, parallel universes. Now, string theory, you looked at that and you worked on that for a number of years. Assuming it is correct, you believe it is. What does it all mean about parallel universes?
Well, you know, we have the Large Hadron Collider, this gigantic machine outside Geneva, Switzerland. It found the Higgs boson recently, and that made headlines around the world. But you see, the Higgs boson is just the beginning. Because there's a theory beyond the Higgs boson called string theory. And we think that the Higgs boson is nothing but the lowest octave of a vibrating string. And everything you see around you is nothing but the lowest octave of tiny little rubber bands vibrating in the lowest space. But the next octave will give us new forms of matter, like dark matter. And these strings vibrate not just in three dimensions, they vibrate in 11 dimensions. And this freaks people out when we first tell people this. But we think that there could be other dimensions. This is something right out of Twilight Zone or Star Trek. But we think that our universe is a bubble. According to Einstein, the bubble is expanding. That's the Big Bang theory. But we think there could be other bubbles out there, that our bubble is a three-dimensional bubble floating in an 11-dimensional arena with other bubbles. So this is called the multiverse idea, the idea that our universe is not alone. That there could be other bubbles out there in a bubble bath. Stephen Hawking, for example, calls them baby universes. There could be bubbles floating around everywhere that we coexist with. Now, sometimes these bubbles can bump into each other and coalesce into a big bubble, or maybe peel off a small bubble. And that's called the Big Bang Theory. So we think we can actually go before the instant of Genesis. We think we can go back before the beginning of time, into a universe, a multiverse, where there were parallel universes that collide and peel off and fission, and that could explain creation itself. Now, if this is true, this means that parallel universes could be one of the dominant features of existence, that there could be other realities out there, and the laws of physics may actually change in some of these other universes. You know, sometimes it's said that certain things violate the laws of physics, therefore they're impossible. Well, if this theory is true, then there could be other laws of physics in these other universes as well. The things that are considered, quote, impossible in our universe may become commonplace in other universes. Now, you may say to yourself, well, all this is nice, you know, sounds like Star Trek or Twilight Zone, but how do you prove it? We want to prove it with a Large Hadron Collider. This $10 billion machine, we hope, will find the next vibrations of vibrating strings, and they're called particles or superparticles, and we think that makes up dark matter. Dark matter, we think, is 10 times more plentiful than ordinary matter, and already every single high school textbook on the planet Earth has to be rewritten because every textbook says that the universe is made out of atoms. Well, sorry about that. That's not true. We now realize that only 4% of the universe is made out of atoms. 23% is made out of dark matter, invisible matter. And 73% of the universe is made out of dark energy. So if I had dark matter in my hand, for example, it would be invisible. It would then sift right through my fingers, go right through the crust of the Earth, go right through the center of the Earth, all the way to China, reverse direction because of gravity, and then come all the way back to New York City again, and then vibrate from New York City and China. That's how strange dark matter is. But we think that, you know, most of the matter of the universe is invisible, is dark matter. And it's nothing but the next octave of tiny little rubber bands that make up the entire universe.
Why is dark matter necessary, Michio?
Well, at first we thought that there was no such thing as dark matter, that a galaxy is a galaxy and that's all there is to it. Now we realize that the galaxies, like a Milky Way, have a halo that holds the galaxy together. Now, our Milky Way galaxy spins too fast. By rights, it should fly apart. If you simply get Newton's laws of motion, calculate a spinning galaxy, you find that it spins 10 times too fast. So by rights, the Earth should be flung into outer space. But, you know, the Earth is not flung into outer space. We're quite stable. We go around the Milky Way galaxy. So what holds the galaxy together? We think that there's a halo of dark matter that surrounds the Milky Way galaxy, keeping it together, and that there's dark matter everywhere, but it's invisible, so it's very hard to detect. So now we want to create dark matter with the Large Hadron Collider. The Large Hadron Collider can create antimatter. We've done that, been there, done that. But now we want to create not just the Higgs boson, but dark matter. That is a new form of matter never seen on the planet Earth. Dark matter, which would simply represent the next octave of a vibrating string. And these strings, like I said, vibrate in 11 dimensions. And that's why we're forced to consider a multiverse of universes. So the universe turned out to be a lot stranger than we thought. All the high school textbooks are being rewritten now to accommodate this fact.
How could all this come about, Michio? I mean, without talking about a creator, I mean, how did this happen?
Well, no one knows. I mean, Einstein was asked this question an awful lot, right? In Einstein's equations, you get the Big Bang, right? You start with the universe expands, you run the videotape backwards, and then you get a Big Bang. Well, then where did the Big Bang come from?
That's right, exactly.
We're stuck with that fact. Well, now we have string theory, which allows us to go back before the Big Bang. I mean, there are a lot of conferences of physicists now where we talk about pre-Big Bang physics. And if our universe is a bubble, did the bubble simply pop into existence 13.7 billion years ago? That doesn't seem likely. I mean, how can you get something from nothing, right?
We think
there was something before the beginning of time. And what happened was an explosion of some sort created by these bubbles bumping into each other or peeling off a baby bubble. And so we think we can actually go backwards before creation. Now, NASA hopefully will launch a satellite in 10 years called LISA, Laser Interferometry Space Antenna, which may prove this theory. It's three laser beams connecting three satellites, making a triangle in outer space. The triangle is 3 million miles across. And any vibration that's still ricocheting around the universe from the Big Bang will jiggle the satellites and cause the laser beams to be disturbed, which can be picked up. That machine, because it's 3 million miles long, is so sensitive that it can actually detect radiation from the instant of the Big Bang. These are called gravity waves. And so we even think we can pick up the shock waves of the instant of creation. In other words, get baby pictures of Genesis. And then we run the videotape backwards, even before the beginning, and we should find evidence of an umbilical cord of the baby universe before the Big Bang, perhaps connecting our universe to a parallel universe. And so this is a very serious proposal now being made to NASA, that we launched LISA to find out what happened before Genesis chapter 1, verse 1.
Michio, with all that's been going on with this theory of string theory, which you developed it how long ago?
Oh, well, the theory goes all the way back to the late 60s. We were smashing atoms even back then. And there was a formula called the Veneziano formula that seemed to fit the scattering of pi mesons. And we were wondering, how can a formula be so accurate that it can describe the scattering of pi mesons? And then we realized that it was actually vibrating strings, that strings were bumping into each other. And if we assumed that each note of a string is a particle, that would explain why there's so many particles. You know, there are hundreds of subatomic particles that we've identified, hundreds of them.
Hundreds.
With all these kinds of bizarre names, pi mesons and leptons and hadrons and Yang-Mills particles. And it's hard to believe that Mother Nature could be so vicious as to create hundreds of fundamental particles. So we now think that what's fundamental is not all these particles. What's fundamental is a string, that all these particles are nothing but notes, little notes on tiny rubber bands. And we think that could be the fundamental basis of why we have hundreds and thousands of subatomic particles.
These other dimensions, are they the same as other universes, or is that something else?
Well, these dimensions are like an arena. Think of an arena in which particles and atoms can perform their dance. And we think that's how the universe is structured, that the arena is the dimensions of space-time, and that matter can perform its magic by dancing on the stage of these dimensions. So Einstein thought that maybe the stage could be curved. So he introduced the concept of a curved stage. So when actors and actresses walk on the stage of life, the stage actually is curved. and that's what we call gravity. But now we realize that the stage could have trap doors, perhaps wormholes, gateways, that may connect you with other stages. That maybe our stage is not alone. That maybe there's a trap door. And if you fall in the trap door, you wind up on another stage.
That's right.
And this trap door could be somewhat similar to a black hole. So if you fall into a black hole, perhaps you're shot out the other end of a white hole. So a white hole may connect you to a black hole. So everything falls into a black hole, and then it's shot out the other end of a white hole. Now, some people even think, some of my friends even believe, that the universe is a white hole. So if you look at all the structure of the Big Bang, it really does look like, you know, a white hole blowing matter out. So maybe that's what happened with the Big Bang, that the Big Bang was nothing but the connection of our universe with an umbilical cord to another black hole. So according to this theory, we live inside a black hole. The universe is a black hole, and we are inside it. And why is it expanding? It's expanding because we're actually a certain type of black hole called the white hole. Now, this sounds like science fiction, but I tell you, there's serious physicists who believe this idea.
And is it possible that there could be other universes within almost every black hole?
Yeah, that's actually a possibility, that on the other side of a black hole, there's perhaps another universe. Now, we should point out, however, no one's ever done this. No one's ever shot a rocket into a black hole. What falls in never comes out. So we'll never know what's on the other side of a black hole. But if you just do the math, if you just take Einstein's equations and follow a rocket through a black hole, it winds up on a parallel universe. So there's a gateway, a portal on the other side of a black hole. Now, we used to think you could never make it through. In fact, Einstein himself thought you could never make it through.
You get, what, torn to bits?
Yeah. However, now we realize that these black holes spin, and they spin very rapidly. We clock them, in fact, with our telescopes. And now we realize that at the center of a black hole is probably a ring, not just a dot. A dot would kill you because you fall into it, you get crushed.
Like the eye of a storm?
Yeah, that's right. So if you have a hurricane, of course, does not collapse to a dot. It collapses to a funnel. Well, think of a black hole that collapses to a funnel. What it looks like is a ring. And if you fall through the ring, you fall through the looking glass of Alice. So you wind up in a parallel universe. So again, we can't prove it, but we think that at the center of a black hole, there's a ring. If you fall through the ring, it's like putting your hand through the looking glass of Alice. Your hand winds up on the other side of forever. And that's called a wormhole. So Stephen Hawking has looked at this, and he's asked himself the question, how stable are these wormholes? These wormholes could even be time machines. They would be gateways to other universes, maybe to the past, maybe to the future, maybe to another point in space and time. But the question is stability. How stable are these things? Can you make it through? Will it collapse when you fall through it? That's a big mystery. Stephen Hawking's latest thinking was that you might perhaps die in the process of falling through this time machine. But we're not sure. These calculations are very hard to do. And string theory, we think, will eventually give us the answer. But the mathematics is horrendous.
Well, theoretically, if someone, Mitchell, was going through a wormhole, what would they see on the sides, for example, as they go through this tunnel?
Well, it would be very strange. First of all, as you go toward a black hole, from the outside, time slows down. So it looks as if you're flying through the black hole in slow motion. Okay. Now, as you fall into a black hole, you fall into it almost instantly. You go right through. But from the outside, because time slows down from the outside, it looks like you're headed toward the black hole in slow motion. Okay. However, you fall right through. Now, as you fall through what is called the event horizon is a black sphere that surrounds the black hole, you would then see light that was trapped perhaps millions of years ago, because, of course, light cannot escape. So as you fall through the black hole, you see images of things that are millions of years old. You can actually see the black hole as it formed billions of years ago, because you're seeing light that was trapped in the wormhole millions of years ago. But as you go toward the very center, you should see this ring. And as you get toward the ring, there are computer simulations of this, by the way. I've seen computers that have tried to simulate what happens when you go through the ring.
That's got to be wild looking.
It's a wild ride, right? As you go through the ring, at the very center, another universe begins to open up. you begin to see essentially stars from another universe open up. So this little hole begins to get bigger and bigger and bigger as you go through the ring. And as you go through the ring, the hole becomes as big as the ring itself, and you see different stars. You see a totally different set of constellations because you, of course, are on another universe. And so, again, this is theory, but this is where the theory takes you. It takes you to a parallel universe.
Would you theoretically be going through it faster than the speed of light?
No, you may be going through it slower than the speed of light. However, because you've gone to another point in the galaxy, let's say hypothetically, it means that objectively you went much faster than the speed of light. But as you went through the gateway, you did not go faster than the speed of light. It's like taking a shortcut through a subway system, right? You on the subway system are still going at the same rate. You don't see anything different. But you've taken a shortcut from A to B. And that's what you're doing. You're taking a shortcut through space and time by drilling a hole through space and time. Now, remember, Einstein himself introduced this concept back in 1935. He wrote the first paper on this. That's why we call them Einstein-Rosen bridges. On Star Trek, they call them wormholes. But we physicists call them Einstein-Rosen bridges, because he was the one who first introduced these things. Now, Einstein himself didn't think you could go through. He thought that you would die in the process of going to a parallel universe. But now we see rotating black holes. All the black holes we see with the Hubble Space Telescope are rotating very rapidly, about 1,000,000 miles an hour, in fact. And so now we think that at the center of the black hole are rings. And this is something that Einstein never considered. He never considered rotating black holes, in which case you would get rings, not dots, at the center. And these rings could be gateways, portholes, perhaps, to another dimension.
You know, earlier astronomers discovered a planet that wanders throughout
universe.
I mean, it must have its own internal heat source, I would guess, right?
Yeah, isn't this freaky? We used to think that all planets go around stars. And just last week, we found another rogue planet, as they're called, wandering in space. And this could mean that perhaps life is much more common than we thought, because if you have a moon going around one of these rogue planets, tidal forces, that is the squeezing of the moon by the gravity of the mother planet, is sufficient to create heat inside the core of a moon, melt the ice, and create a liquid ocean. So even in our own solar system, if you look at Jupiter, there's a moon called Europa. It's covered with ice because it's so far from the sun. But underneath the ice, there's a liquid ocean, maybe even room temperature. We don't know. Because of volcanic activity at the center of Europa is quite hot, and it's heated up by friction caused by the gravity of Jupiter. And so if you calculate the volume of the ocean of Europa, it's bigger than the volume of Earth's ocean. Earth's ocean is quite thin, you know, about 4 or 5 miles deep at the maximum. But Europa's oceans are much bigger, so there's actually more water, more liquid water, in a moon of Jupiter than on the Earth. And liquid water is the amniotic fluid of life. It's the universal solvent. It's the amniotic fluid where DNA first got off the ground. And so if we have these rogue planets, we used to think they're frozen solid, so, you know, kind of uninteresting. But we now realize that these moons going around these rogue planets could be like Europa, in which case, there could be many, many, many more platforms for life than we thought. So again, all the high school textbooks are being rewritten. All the high school textbooks say that we have to look for Earth-like planets in the Goldilocks zone from the sun, not too close, not too far from the sun.
Right.
If the Earth is too close, water freezes. If the Earth is too far, if the Earth is too close, water boils. If the Earth is too far, water freezes from the sun. But now we realize that we could have oceans on Europa, and oceans on rogue planets, on moons of rogue planets. And so this vastly increases the possibility of life in outer space. So like I said, all the textbooks are being rewritten. Sorry about that if high school kids are listening to this program. But your book is now out of date.
Could these rogue planets get captured by other solar systems?
Yeah, you know, that's also another problem. These things are potentially dangerous. Because, first of all, you can't see them. They're very hard to detect. We have to use infrared sensors to detect them. They creep up on you. And, you know, they were thrown out of a solar system by perhaps getting too close to a Jupiter-sized planet. They got flung out like a slingshot.
Hold on for a second, Michio. We're going to come right back. I want to pick that up. It's fascinating. And we'll take phone calls. with Michio Kaku next on Coast to Coast AM.